This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
I'm Jerome Manigan. I have stories for you from the April 2011 issue of The Good Old Days magazine. We're starting today's program with Looking Hollywood Way. It's written by Mary O'Donnell. Since the invention of the motion picture camera, there have been many stars of the big screen and television who burned brightly for a brief time and then faded from memory. Relatively few have remained household names. Among that few is a zany redhead. All you have to say is, "I love Lucy," and immediately both young and old know of whom you are speaking. This year marks what would have been Lucille Ball's 100th birthday. In addition, the television show that initially brought her into our homes was first broadcast 60 years ago. Her antics on that groundbreaking sitcom continue to make us smile and laugh out loud as episodes are rebroadcast year after year. Lucille Desiree Ball was born August 6, 1911, in Jamestown, New York. According to Lucille, The Life of Lucille Ball by Kathleen Brady, Lucille's early life was full of uncertainty. While working in Michigan as a lineman for a telephone company in 1915, her father died of typhoid fever. Her mother, Desiree, was pregnant with Lucille's brother Fred at the time. Lucille's mother returned to New York and worked several jobs to support the family. There she met and later married Ed Peterson, a man who didn't really care much for children. When she got a job in Detroit, Desiree followed her husband. Fred remained with Desiree's parents, Fred and Flora Hunt, who lived in Cileron, New York. Lucille, then age 8, was placed with Ed's parents, who lived in Jamestown. Ed's mother was harshly strict, and she did everything she could to curtail Lucille's natural exuberance, making sure that Lucy was dressed plainly and kept busy with chores. Ed and Desiree returned from Detroit in 1922. At last, Lucille was reunited with her own extended family, living in the same house in Celeron where her mother, stepfather, and brother Fred, her grandparents, and her aunt Lola and 4-year-old daughter Cleo, whom Lucille and Fred looked upon as a little sister. Lucille felt free to perform and entertain, which she did for any family member who would stop and watch her as she danced and sang on her stage, The Staircase. Lucille found that she was drawn to entertainment that made people laugh. She didn't just enjoy the performances of actors and comedians, she studied them. She went to nearby Celeron Park to watch the free outdoor movies, silent era films that featured comics like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin. Lucille's rather eccentric grandfather often took the children to vaudeville shows, where Lucille was captivated by the performer's ability to make audiences laugh. Her grandfather encouraged all of the children to participate in school plays and to produce their own shows. In high school, Lucille directed and starred in a play she wrote herself. In late 1926, Lucille began attending the School of Dramatic Arts in New York City, where the star of the class was Bette Davis. Lucille found the program difficult and the instructors critical. Instead of blossoming, she retreated farther into her shell at each harsh word. Only a few weeks later, she was back home, having been told that she had no future at all as a performer because of her shyness. The next summer, a tragedy struck, which would result in the breakup of Lucille's home. A young boy who was visiting was accidentally shot and paralyzed by his young cousin, a girl who was also a visitor to the house. Fred Hunt, as the owner of the property, was held legally responsible, and he was required to pay the injured boy's parents $5,000. Not having that sort of cash, the only alternative was to sell the house. With the loss of the house, Lucille, young Fred, and their mother and stepfather went to live in a small apartment in Jamestown. Aunt Lola went to another city to study nursing and sent her daughter, Cleo, to live with her father. Fred Hunt, who was now a widower, moved from place to place looking for work. Knowing that she would have to make her own way in the world, Lucille returned to New York in 1929, changed her name to Diane Belmont, and eventually landed a job as a fashion model. Even so, Lucille felt isolated, and she missed her family. She returned to Jamestown, and in 1930, using her real name again, she landed a role in a play put on by the local theatrical society. While she was not the star of the production, she stole the show and got rave reviews in the local newspapers. This gave her the confidence she needed to once again pursue her real dream, which was to be an actress and to make audiences laugh. Lucille returned to New York, working as a model and in retail, so that she could support herself while she auditioned for acting jobs. In 1933, she got a chance to go to Hollywood as a Goldwyn girl in Eddie Cantor's film Roman Scandals. Years later, Lucille recalled, "Suddenly, I was in show business. It interested me because I was learning, and because I was learning, I never complained. Whatever they asked, I did. I did one line, two lines, with animals, in mud packs, seltzer in the face. Eddie Cantor noticed it first at Goldwyn. He'd say, 'Give it to that girl. She doesn't mind.'" Lucille went on to appear in more than 30 movies and shorts between 1933 and 1936, mostly in uncredited roles. As she was learning about the movie business, she was also forming friendships. Many people whom she befriended during this period would later work with her in TV, including William Frawley, who played Fred Mertz in I Love Lucy, and Gail Gordon, who was her co-star in the sitcoms that followed. Her hard work also allowed her to fulfill another wish, to reunite her family. She rented a house and fixed it up. Her brother Fred arrived first, followed by her mother, who was by then separated from Ed Peterson, her grandfather, and her cousin Cleo, whose mother had died a few years earlier. In 1936, Lucille landed one of the leading roles in Stage Door, along with her close friend Ginger Rogers, Katharine Hepburn, and Adolphe Menjou. After that, she had a string of B-movies, so much so that she became known as Queen of the Bees. In 1940, while working on the movie Too Many Girls, she met a young Cuban band leader named Desi Arnaz. Lucille said of their meeting, "It wasn't love at first sight. It took a full 5 minutes." Lucille and Desi married in November of that same year, beginning a 20-year partnership that extended from their personal lives into their business lives. Early in her career, Lucy often changed her hair color. In 1943, she starred in her first color film, Dewberry Was a Lady, with Red Skelton and Gene Kelly. For that film, MGM hairstylist Sidney Guleroff colored her hair the orange-red color that became her enduring signature. Throughout the 1940s, Lucille continued making movies, and Desi toured with his band. But they wanted to have children, so they decided to try to make a television series that would allow them to stay together in one place. On October the 15th, 1951, I Love Lucy debuted on CBS, and it was an almost immediate hit. From that effort, Lucille and Desi formed their production company, Desi Lou. They pioneered techniques of producing their sitcom that are still used today. They also wisely retained the rights to their show. The original series ran from 1951 to 1957. During that interval, Lucille and Desi also found time to make two movies together, The Long, Long Trailer and Forever Darling. Daughter Lucy was born in July 1951. Famously, Lucille was pregnant with son Desi Jr. during the run of the TV show, and he was born in 1953. At the end of I Love Lucy's run, the couple continued on television with the Desi Lucy Comedy Hour from 1957 to 1960. Lucille and Desi divorced in 1960, and after buying out his share of Desi Lou, she continued as head of the studio and had two more long-running TV shows that revolved around a character named Lucy. She also made several more movies, including Yours, Mine, and Ours with Henry Fonda. Lucille married Gary Morton in 1961, and their marriage endured for 28 years until her death. At Lucille's last public appearance on the 61st Academy Awards show, she and her fellow presenter, longtime friend and frequent co-star Bob Hope, received a standing ovation. A month later, on April the 26th, 1989, Lucille Ball died from heart problems. Today, I Love Lucy is televised in more than 77 countries, and the program has been dubbed in 22 languages. Every year, new fans come to appreciate the comedy of Lucille Ball. In the town of her birth, Jamestown, New York, fans can visit the Lucille Ball Desi Arnaz Center, which is overseen by Lucy and Desi Jr. The facility includes the Lucy Desi Museum and a theater. Lucille would be pleased that her legacy includes a place to celebrate and inform others about the art of making people laugh. Looking Hollywood Way was written by Mary O'Donnell. And in the April 2011 issue of the Good Old Days magazine, we're turning to Memories of My Grandparents. It's written by Christine Meadows. I am 88 years old, and I know that when my generation is gone, no one will know how times were when I was a child, unless they are written down. I was a child during the Great Depression. Five of us, my parents, a brother, a sister, and I lived in a three-room house. We had no electricity, indoor plumbing, telephone, TV, radio, or car. We lived off the country road, so the mail route didn't come to our house. We walked about a mile and a half to our mailbox and about 2 miles to church, rain or shine, every Sunday. The one-room school was within sight of our house, close enough that we walked home for lunch and back. The only entertainment we had was visiting our neighbors, and oh, the joy of going to my grandparents. Grandpa was the sentimental one. He coddled us in his lap, always kissed us goodnight, and called us his babies until we were grown. About once a month, all the family would walk about 3 miles to their house and spend the night. Granny didn't show her affection openly, but she spoiled us in so many ways. We couldn't afford a daily newspaper, and she knew we kids loved the funnies, so she saved them from one visit to the next, stacked in the stairwell. She also cooked special treats for us. For breakfast, she would split open a big fluffy buttermilk biscuit, cover it in homemade butter, sprinkle sugar on top, and then put it back in the oven until it was toasty brown. Then we put it in a cereal bowl and poured cream over it. What a treat! And she always had cornflakes. How many remember that big yellow box with red letters, Post Toasties Cornflakes? There were jams and jellies of all kinds, too, and a bowl of honey. Grandpa raised bees. In the center of the table, she also gave us good advice, especially on how to act like a lady. There were so many things there that we didn't have at home. One was a telephone. Their party line rang on all the phones. What fun it was to eavesdrop on the neighbors' calls. One girl on the line courted with her boyfriend every night on the phone. Grandpa was one of the first in the neighborhood to own a car. It was a Model T that had to be hand-cranked to start, and there were no windows, just curtains that they put up in winter. But what a luxury! They had a big fireplace with a mantle over it and a wind-up clock. To this day, I can smell wood smoke and hear a clock tick, shut my eyes, and imagine I'm at Grandpa's. There were two things in Granny's parlor that we didn't have, a pump organ and a gramophone. None of us kids could play the organ, but she let us bang on it to our heart's content. It was a very elaborate piece of furniture with a mirror, whatnot shelves, and carvings. Sitting on a shelf was a China religious figurine that my great-great-grandparents had brought from Ireland when they came over during the potato famine. The gramophone was a little square box that sat on a table and had to be wound up with a crank to play. It had once had a morning glory horn, but someone had removed it. Songs back then told a story. The Wreck of Old 97, Little Rosewood Casket, The Letter Edged in Black, Story of Floyd Collins, Little Marion Parker, Silver Threads Among the Gold, and such, and we played them over and over. Then there was the attic to play in. That's where the gramophone's morning glory horn resided. Another attraction was Uncle Johnny's army uniform. He had served in World War I. His metal helmet, gas mask, wraparound leggings, and the rest of the uniform were there to dress up in. My grandparents also had animals, sheep, goats, guineas, and battens, that we didn't have. Grandpa named everything. One time we had a pair of Chinese chickens he named Wheeze and Jones. They had feathered top knots, and their legs and feet were covered in downy feathers. Grandpa said they looked like they were wearing pajamas. He also had a big red mule named Spondylax and twin calves named Lollipop and Mallycop. There was a huge cherry tree in the backyard at Grandma and Grandpa's, and in the side yard there was a peach, a damson, and a nectarine tree, along with a line of beehives. When I was 13, my grandmother took sick. I was sent up there to help do the work and wait on her. She lived for 2 months. They stopped the clocks on the minute she died, and they covered all the mirrors. This was before the days of leaving a body in the funeral home. The undertaker came and got her, prepared her body for burial, and then brought her back home in a casket. The funeral was held in the home. The only thing I remember about it was that a girl who went to church with her sang "Beautiful Isle of Somewhere." That was the first time I had heard that song, and when I hear it today, I think of Granny. After that, Grandpa lived alone for about 20 years. Until we married, my sister and I would go up and spend the night with him. No matter what we cooked for supper, he would brag on it and say, "It's not what we've got, but because there is someone to eat with me." I have tried to make memories for my 3 grandkids and 3 great-grandkids. We play board games, I read to them, and we have colored together and baked cookies. Our lifestyle is different now, but I hope their memories of me will be happy ones. Memories of My Grandparents was written by Christine Meadows. And let's turn to this. My Dream Job is written by Ellen Nicole. In 1939, when I was 15, my cousin Bobby and I had a childhood tiff. To make up, he offered to take me to a Rochester Red Wings AAA baseball game. Back then, Rochester was a farm team for the Baltimore Orioles major league team in the American League. To encourage women to get interested in professional baseball, ladies' night admission was 20 cents. I became a real devotee and began collecting newspaper clippings in a scrapbook. Some players became very famous major leaguers in that era. Then the war started and everything changed. The manager was Billy Southworth. And some players I remember were Marty Marion, Preacher Rowe, Whitey Koreski, and Estelle Crabtree. One day, I read a squib that the International League of Baseball Clubs was relocating to Rochester from New York City. Member teams were Buffalo, Columbus, Jersey City, Montreal, Newark, Rochester, Syracuse, and Toronto. I wrote to Tommy Richardson, president of the International League, asking to be considered for a secretary's job at the league office, and then I forgot it. Then, one day, I got a call to come in for an interview. I entered a 3-office suite in the Sheraton Hotel. It was filled with musty papers, cigar smoke, and an ancient typewriter. I didn't want the job, but Tommy and the treasurer, Harry Simmons, talked me into it. I began to go to Red Wing games again. Every female baseball fan in Rochester envied me. I worked for the International League of Professional Baseball Clubs from 1964 to 1968. My duties consisted of mailing out the annual passes, typing up player rosters for all 8 teams, handling umpire contracts, forwarding umpires' mail, ordering mud from Pennsylvania for pitchers to use to dirty up the new balls, answering the telephone, and running a temperamental mimeograph machine. Computers were unheard of. Besides all that, there were many moments when nothing was going on. In 1966, I met a beloved whittled baseball writer, Al C. Weber, and we married. The Red Wings always sent him to spring training in Daytona Beach, and he wanted me to go with him. But to do so, I had to resign my interesting job. Leaving the Rochester winter to go to Florida with the team was a highlight for both of us. I was important to him because I knew baseball so well, and together we compiled game reports from his scorebook to send to the company that kept all the records. He always sat in the press box on the roof, and I sat in the boxes below the screen near home plate. Later, the Red Wings became a AAA farm team of the Minnesota Twins. The Wings built a stadium called Frontier Field, which I visited in 1998 to attend the induction of my husband, Al Weber, into the Rochester Baseball Hall of Fame. But the old Silver Stadium is where I spent my most enjoyable times. Al passed away in his sleep on May the 12th, 1972. We had shared a glorious 5 years. My Dream Job was written by Eileen Nicole. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information, by Cole Ross.